WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You started tap dancing lessons at, I think, the age of five. Did you want to do it yourself, or were you pushed into it by the family at first?
Well, actually, they came around with free tap dancing lessons. And my mother, I was five, and so I went just because it was free, and she thought I might like it, never thinking that I would love it. I think it was about four lessons. And my brother was three. Gregory was three. And they wouldn't take him because they felt at three you couldn't retain any of the steps. And I used to come home and teach Gregory, and he would learn just like he does now, which is extremely fast. And then one day, we were always together, and he snuck away from our mother, and he was inside dancing, and the teacher said, oh, my goodness, he can retain all. So that's really how we started dancing together and loving it.
Your teacher first was Henry Letang.
No, he came.
Well, he came in later.
Later. We had a guy named Wally Wanger, which was over top the Lowy's Theater on 125th Street. And then my mother, we liked it so much, she decided to get a better teacher. And she found Henry Letang and brought us to him. And he's the gentleman who is responsible for the kind of tap that we do, which is a close floor tap, which is dropping the heels to make a syncopated sound as opposed to just dropping the heels to like a period at the end of a sentence. So that was the style, which was primarily a black style. It happened when John Bubbles of Buck and Bubbles did that. I think maybe it was because John maybe was flat-footed. I don't even know. But he did it in such a way that you became a musician, a drummer, a percussionist. And that revolutionized tap.
Did you start performing with musicians then?
Oh, yes. Oh, well, we started performing. I think the first job we were 6 and 8, because we got with Henry at 5 and 7. And a year later, we were performing. He realized that we were the closest he had seen to the Nicholas Brothers. And so we got adult steps. We never did kiddie steps. So it was difficult, but we loved it so much, and we loved that attention, and Henry was so good with us, you know.
So what were your initial impressions of show business when you were six?
Oh, it was fun. It was fantasy, you know. And my mother, being a very sheltered lady, she knew nothing about show business. Our grandmother on my father's side was a Cotton Club showgirl, you see. But she knew, but my mother didn't know. And she was never the kind of mother that would push us. And as long as we liked it, we could continue it. But if we didn't like it, we could stop anytime we wanted.
Were your early experiences with audiences good experiences?
Oh, they were great. They loved us. They loved us. I think mainly because we didn't we weren't cute, you know. We really worked hard. And we used to dance at the Audubon Ballroom, which was a ballroom in Harlem, for quarters and to help with the rent in front of orchestras. Machito, Tito Puente, any orchestra that came through there. And my mother was a waitress there, so my father was a bouncer. And we'd do it, and we'd pick up the quarters. And so the audiences loved us, and so we liked it right from the start.
When did your father enter the act?
Not till 1959. We were in London, and we decided tap had sort of died down. And we came at really at the end of the popularity of it. We went to Europe and stayed there a long time because tap never died in Europe. So a lot of the dancers were over there. The Nicholas Brothers were over there and John Bubbles and had great careers. So we went over there, and then we decided in London that we were going to start to sing. And that's when we joined my father. He had a little trio and learned how to do that through lounges and hard work.
Would you describe what the act was like?
It was just singing and dancing and really just throwing numbers in. It wasn't very structured. It didn't get structured till we met the gentleman who's still my manager, Stanley Kay. And that was 1963 at the Playboy Club in Atlanta. And he structured the act.
When you and your brother were performing with your father, did he play the role of father when you were touring and when you were on stage?
No, not really, because as far as on the performance level, my father got into it late. So we had more or less the experience, so we sort of ran it, you know. The image was very good, you know, because they liked the idea, and we would play that image because off stage it was like that, but never on stage. He would always bow to our experience and knowledge of it, you know, if we wanted to try something new or wanted him to do anything new. He was a tough customer, but I was very involved with controlling the act, because Gregory had to have freedom to create. And my job was as a straight man, you see. And then I would rehearse the orchestra, organize the lights, I would do everything. So they more or less would listen to me then.
What kind of music did you then like to dance to? We'll talk about the music you're using now a little later.
Well, we were very theater-oriented. So we did medleys from Fiddler on the Roof. We did My Fair Lady. We did a lot of stuff like that. Then when we started to get more into the rock, we would do Stephen Stills. There was a guy named Jonathan Edwards, and there was one, Carole King. Songs like that. And we were evolving into that, which eventually brought us to the breakup, where we broke up, because then I wanted more theater, and Gregory wanted to go more rock and roll. So we broke up, and we eventually went our separate ways, even though I lived with him in L.A. for a while, trying to get my bearings.
So was that mostly the reason for the split up of,
yes, it
of
was.
You and the
we
music?
Were, and I think to save our relationship and love for each other as brothers, we decided to break up because we knew that if we stayed together, we'd begin to fight more than we were already. And for the salvation of our love for each other, that's when we broke up.
Was it difficult to figure out a style of dancing as a single dancer as opposed to part of a team?
No, because we were always very different anyway. I was always into ballet and jazz, too. I had seen a gentleman by the name of Teddy Hale, who was a great, great dancer, who had line, more balletic line. He used to do something to begin the begin. And I'd seen the Nicholas Brothers, of course, who had line. And then when I saw Fred Astaire, I wanted to cover all those bases. So I was always interested in being more than, I don't want to say like just a hoofer, but hoofing was what we did. And then when I discovered I wanted to do more, then I evolved slowly through the years to where I am now.
Did you ever, go back for ballet or jazz lessons?
Oh, sure. Like no, I went into intensive study. Sure. I went and took ballet classes and jazz classes. And I did. I started that back after we had broken up, and I was, 30. And now my legs are wonderful. I mean, it's hard. It's very painful, you know, just all of a sudden stretch those hamstrings after never having had to do that. But I loved it so much, and I wanted it so badly that I went through all of it.
Ballet, you're supposed to start ballet when you're 8 or something, when you're really young. Mm. Was it hard as a 30-year-old to start ballet lessons?
Yes, it was. It was. It was very difficult and very painful. But when you want something, you don't really, feel it. The pain is if you were saying, okay, well, I have to do this. I wanted to take 2 or 3 classes a day, which I did.
If you're just joining us, my guest is dancer Maurice Hines, who is the founder of the company Ballet Tap USA. During the 50s and 60s, did you feel the waning of tap popularity?
Well, I did to a certain degree, although most of the tappers that we knew were black. And they were working all the time.
Where?
Oh, in Europe and in clubs in Las Vegas. They'd be working. I don't think that it was the kind of thing where it was on Broadway. Once Oklahoma opened, you see, and Agnes DeMille had brought dance to that level, they didn't really feel the tap could tell a story within, could be part of the story like her work was. So then it dropped off of Broadway. But other than that, it was still going very strong. You know, a lot of people think of tap coming back now, but I think one of the reasons it came back was through Ruby Keeler and Nono Nanette. And no one seems to talk about her. When I saw her on the Tonys tapping, and she did very, extremely well, and the number was constructed very well, I was pleased to see that. You know, it was on the Tony Awards. It was a big deal. So then the other tap shows started coming slowly. That was the early 70s. And then you became Sugar Babies, 42nd Street. And now with my one and only A Tap Dance Kid, it's come to, Ben Sophisticated Ladies also, I might add, was wonderful. But now with what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to take it to another level. And by putting it in concert dance as opposed to Broadway.
Yeah, why do you want to do that?
Well, because when Sophisticated Ladies closed, and I was doing it for a year on Broadway, I wanted to do something else. I didn't want to do movies at that time because I was only offered like pimp roles and drug pushes, and I didn't want to do that. So then I said, okay, now you want to choreograph. I didn't want to do another Broadway show because I just finished that for a year and I wanted to rest. So I said, now how can you be a choreographer? I mean, your friends like Billy Wilson, George Faison, Louis Johnson, they have Tony nominations and Tonys, and they can't get a show. So I realized the racism in the theater right now, well, it's always been there, but now I have to deal with it because I wanted to choreograph. I said, I have no track record. Why would they hire me? I haven't even proven it to myself that I could do it. So I said, well, my mother and I talked about it. And I said, well, I'll start one of my own. Why not? You know, give it a shot. And it sort of evolved into some dancers came by the studio, my studio in New York. And I gave them a little step here. I gave this one a little step. And then I talked with Mercedes Ellington, who was the co-director of the company. It was very encouraging. And then she said, well, let me, you know, let's try something. So that's what happened. It was planned, and yet it wasn't planned.
Could you describe the different styles of dancing that the company uses?
Yeah, it's kind of hard in that most people, they see tap like 42nd Street, and they come with a preconceived idea of what it is. And all of a sudden, they're doing sauté arabesques and the rond de jambes in the air and all the tours, and they're coming down and doing wings and the double pullbacks and all that. So it's hard to describe. You really have to see it to understand it. What I have found is that more young people are getting involved with looking at it and enjoying it because we tap also to contemporary music, to Michael Jackson and Michael Cimbello. In fact, the first piece that we do is called Michael, 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 which is sort of a tribute to Mr. Jackson and Michael Cimbello, who wrote Maniac, and Michael McDonald, who sang with the Doobie Brothers. So that's the first piece, and that's rock. And they can't imagine, how do you tap to rock?
I was just going to ask you that.
But that's the difference. If you do the up-in-the-air style, which is basically a white style, which is fine, it's hard to do that because you can only do really a set amount of moves. But if you do close floor work, you can do the variety of steps that you can come up with because you're dropping the heels in a syncopated way, changing the tonal quality, you can go forever.
Could you describe the difference between the up-in-the-air style that you're
yes.
talking about and the close-to-the-floor?
The up-in-the-air style is just on the toes, basically. And it's very high. And the close-to-the-floor, you're dropping the heels very fast and so that you can change the rhythm. You can go long meter. You can go up right with the beat. And rock is easy to do that, too, because it has a very strong bass line, you see. So you just have to hear that, and you can do anything you want.
Is the body posture different?
Yes, yeah. It's you're more pulled up. It means you're really erect. Your posture is straighter.
In which?
In the up in the air style. In the close floor, you're more plié. You're more, your knees are bent more. You're down here. You're grooving with it. It's more of a groove that you can get into. But my dancers have to do both because it is mixed with ballet. And you have to be pulled up. Then you have to plié. Then you have to... I've had difficulty finding dancers. I mean, Baryshnikov couldn't do this because he can't tap. You see, he can be pulled up, but can he get down there, you know? I'm sure he could in time, but it's very difficult to find dancers to do that now.
Is there a certain age group that seems to have, learned tap? Because there was a period when I think a lot of people weren't learning it, and then a period when they started again.
No, they've started back, you know. It's just the kind of tap that I require, there aren't that many teachers that teach it anymore. Henry Letang is in his 70s, and, you know, the knees are going.
Right.
So he doesn't teach it anymore. Gregory and I'm teaching at my school, and Gregory teaches an improvisation class, which is what his genius really is. Make the mind think, as fast as the feet, or a little ahead of the feet, actually. So we're trying to leave that, you know. In fact, when we did the Cotton Club movie, there's a scene in it called The Hoofers Club. And all the great old hoofers that we hadn't seen in years, and they're in their 70s and 80s, they weren't doing steps. And Gregory and I can dance, and we were hard-pressed to keep up with those guys, you know? That's brilliance, though. We'll never see their like again, never.
Dancer Maurice Hines is my guest, if you're just joining us, co-founder of Ballet Tap USA. Well, you're co-starring in Cotton Club.
Yes.
Could you... tell us a capsule of the story.
Well, actually, it's two stories. It's a Richard Gere's side and my brother's side. And Gregory and I play brothers who, it was very, actually, it parallels our life together in a way, our real life, in that we do break up in the movie. I discover him trying to manipulate a solo number once we audition for the Cotton Club and get in it. And I catch him, and of course, I'm very hurt, and we break up. And at the end, we reunite together. And we tap together, and it's wonderfully simple, but yet complex. Francis writes, he wrote the movie as well as directed it, and I can't say enough about him. He is just one of the great men I've ever met as far as working. He's truly creative spirit. And he allows you to be that too. And he wanted the black side of the story. He said, listen, I did The Godfather. I can't improve on that as far as a gangster story. That's a masterpiece. He knows what it is. He's not, no false modesty, and he shouldn't. That's a wonderful movie. Both of them, one and two. But he said, I'm so tired of hearing black people, black actors say, what's happening, baby, that we've got to do something creative. And he let us try things, and I love him. I love you, Francis, if you're listening. I love him.
Was there any advice you gave him about how to achieve authenticity within the clubs?
Oh, yes.
What kind of dance should be included?
Oh, sure. And he was very open to all of that, all the input. But he likes a collaborative way of working anyway. So he hired people who were from the era. He wanted our apartment, we played the Williams brothers. He wanted our apartment to be a replica of the apartments in those days, including the walls. That he went around and feeling the walls. He's such a stickler for detail. It was fascinating to watch that.
What year is it set in?
Well, it starts out, I think, in the late 20s and goes to the early 30s. It's within a five-year span, I think 27 to 31, 32, around there. And he built the Cotton Club, actual nightclub, to scale, just the way it looked. And, in fact, we brought some of the ladies who were the showgirls, including my grandmother, there, and they started crying. Because it was their youth they were seeing, and they never thought that what they were doing was of importance like this, that they were a $40 million movie. I mean, they never thought of it. So they saw the stage, and it was their life right there, their youth. It was so moving.
The style of dancing from the 20s certainly predates your dancing. Was there a different style that you had to learn for the film?
No, because Henry Letang was from that era. In fact, he was 16 years old, and he saw what they did. So what I had to do for me, it's funny, my brother said to me, depressing tapping with him because I've evolved into something else. And he felt that dancing with him must feel like going backwards. And of course, I told him, ridiculous, it's always an honor to dance with my brother. You know, it's an honor and a joy. So, but I had to do that style, which was very close to the floor, even though we did some steps up in the air, but it was more like a team called Pops and Louie, which were from that era. So we did more of that as opposed to just laying them down. It was more mirror dancing, very, very classy, you know. And I recently had to put my taps on the soundtrack, which was arduous. You know, you look at your feet and you have to do that. And I saw the number, and I was very, very pleased with it because I won't see any of the dailies or anything. I don't want to look at myself at all.
Why not?
I think that even though Francis thinks I have a great career as an actor, I think sometimes it's the imperfections of a personality that make you unique. And as a perfectionist, if you see yourself and you don't like something, you want to change it, but it might be that very thing you're changing that makes you different from all the others. So I never wanted to see myself.
Do you read your reviews?
I read them if they're good. I'm not a masochist. I hate bad reviews. I've been very lucky and grateful for the reviews that I've gotten. Gregor and I have only gotten two bad ones in our career. But I don't read them unless they're good.
You've been on Broadway for UB and Sophisticated Ladies.
Uh-huh.
Was that a lifelong ambition of yours since you were interested, I know, in Broadway music when you first started dancing?
Yes, it was. It was. I enjoyed it. To me, it's the work. It's the quality of the work. I didn't want to go on Broadway unless it was quality, you see. So UB was, and Mr. Blake, who I always consider still with us, even though he's passed away, he was so wonderful to us, and he's a very classy and a lot of quality to the man, he and his lovely wife. And, of course, Ellington speaks for itself, you know. So that was a thrill to do that.
Yeah. Let's get back to Cotton Club for a minute.
Sure.
Can you share some of the suggestions that Coppola gave you about acting or dancing,
you know,
on camera?
Yeah, you know what he did? In order to get the part, I had to do improvisation for him.
Acting or dancing?
Acting.
Uh-huh.
And he wanted to see the breakup scene. So we did it. And then I heard 2 months later that I'd gotten it. All he says is, keep it real. And he started calling me Marlon Hines. And, of course, I, like any lover of film, love Marlon Brando. And I said, why are you doing it? He said, because it's probably your innocence in film acting. And because of your theater base, that you give it to me right away. See, Marlon doesn't like to do a lot of retakes. He gives it to me right away. But he gives it in such a real way because You don't care what you look like. You don't care what angle the lights are. You just give me this real thing. You're not interested in it because you don't want to see yourself. So all that's working for you. And he was, I did a scene, the breakup scene was interesting in that the first time we did it, we did, he has a thing about seven, you always have seven takes. And Gregory and I, was improvisation. So Gregory and I are doing, and Gregory didn't give me the cue line, so I was groping for words to get back into the line of the dialogue should go. And afterwards, he loved that. He said, that's like Brando. I said, but Francis, we didn't, you know, we just forgot what we were doing. He said, but you were groping for a way, which you would do if you caught your brother hurting you like that. You wouldn't know what to say. But you groped in character, and that's what Brando does. Lots of dialogue.
So is that the take you're going to use of that?
I think, yeah. He took that one, and I had to cry. See, I have to bring these tears up and then bring them back. He didn't want me to cry because he wanted me to cry in the reunion. So I have to cry, and I say, how could you do this to me? I'm your brother. And then I got to get angry, and I say, well, you wanted a solo act when you've got one on stage and off, and then I exit. And then he wanted anger and hurt. So I did it on the first, third, and seventh take, the tears, to well up enough. Gregory's seen it. He says it's very effective because I don't cry, but you can see, and I'm so hurt, that, but I'm so angry with this pride that I bring it back. And that's Francis.
How did he get you to cry?
He just said, keep it real. The minimum amount of stuff. No whole lot. That's what he says. He doesn't say, you can do it on any of that. He said, keep it real. Let's go.
It must be frustrating when you get something on the first take and the person who you're working with prefers to do it on the seventh take, because some people work at different speeds.
Yes, yes.
Does that ever happen to you, that you're working with someone who's at a completely different pace?
Well, it happened with the young lady that's our mother, Thelma Carpenter. And Francis had to try to help her through it in the kitchen scene, which is at the beginning of the movie. But most of my scenes are with Gregory, and since we've been together, all of my scenes are with him. Since we've been together all these years, it was easy. There was no problem, you know, because we know how each other. My brother doesn't like rehearsals, you see, so he prefers to do it as quickly as possible. So that's why it was good for me when our scenes together.
You're going to see the movie when it comes out?
No, I won't go see it. I'll walk in with my mother to the premiere, I've told her. So she can walk in with her sons, and then I'm going to go out the side door and have dinner and then meet them back at the party. They all know this about me.
What are some of your favorite films with dancing in it?
I love most of the Fred Astaire movies. You know, I think that conceptually he is the genius of all time. I mean, just to think of dancing with coat racks and chairs and pianos and rooms going around, it's quite something. I mean, and his style. I do a tribute to him in the nightclub act that I have, a 20-minute tribute where I do all that stuff. And, you know, you think Fred makes it look so easy. Fred, Mr. Astaire, I apologize. He makes it look so easy, but when you have to dance, he can dance at top speed. All of a sudden, he'll stop and do all this slow motion. Well, I figured, oh, I'm in control. I have this ballet training. Well, the first time I tried it, I almost fell off my feet, you see. And that's greatness to do that. And I don't think any dancer that I know can do that. Also, he defined his own vocabulary of dance, you see. He did things that were his own, which set a standard. As far as the greatest, laying them down in films, I'm talking about, Eleanor Powell was the greatest because she also had stretch. She had 6 o'clock kicks, but she could lay them down there. And she had close floor feet, which were fabulous, I mean. So of the film, there weren't that many black tap dancers on film, which was a shame, you know, because they have taken it to greatness. Honey Coles and Copacetics and the Nicholas Brothers. And they were doing things like Rhonda Jams and stuff, and they were self-taught. No one taught them. They did it on the street. That's how they learned. And then it evolved into clubs. Very similar to breakdancing now.
What would you say about breakdancing?
It's very similar to it.
Oh, yeah.
That tap
uh-huh.
started on the street and then evolved into something else, into an art form, which I think breakdancing is going to do.
Yeah, what do you think of breakdancing?
I think it's fabulous. I think it's a whole new vocabulary of dance, and it comes out of the need to be somebody and channel all that hostility and anger and that they have. And I'm amazed by it. I mean, how do you think of jumping and spinning on your head? I mean, you don't think of that. You just do it. They don't know what it's doing to their bodies, you know. And after they do it for a while, they stop around 17, 18 years old. But it is fabulous. It's fabulous. Now it was on the cover of Dance Magazine. They've accepted it so quickly because they know what it is. And you can't say, well, that's a And that's you can't put a label on it. It's what it is. It'll define itself like every dance form does at the beginning, like Graham did at the beginning, you know, and it's just as important.
What do you think of the solid gold dancers?
I find them interesting, but, you know, they're good dancers. I know a few of them. I don't know Darcelle well, but I know of her work through my partner in my school knows her very well. And they're all wonderful dancers. I think the choreography has the sameness to it, and it's basically exploitive for the women. I don't understand why the costumes have to be that abbreviated and why they're always doing pelvic thrusts all the time. But I understand TV, and I'm sure they're very popular because of it, you know. But they're very good dancers.
There's something that really reminds me of 1950s variety shows and the solid gold choreography.
Oh, yes. Well, they have so much to do and so many numbers. They dance behind all these singers, too, besides doing the countdown thing they do. And a lot of times you don't even see them behind the singers. But they're dancing hard. They're working hard.
What do you look for in tap shoes and in taps?
I look for a treble sound. So I like tell-tone taps.
What are they?
They're sort of like a lighter sound because close flow work is so fast. I happen to dance very fast, and if it's heavy, it'll sound blurred. It'll sound, you know, won't sound clean. But there are some dancers, like in California, that use Morgans, and which are a heavier tap. They're like a heavier sound. The floor that we had made for our concerts is conducive to both, I found. I didn't know that till we started tapping on it in the studio. And then, of course, we have to have special mics to go so that you can turn the tap mics up so that the music, especially the rock stuff, is so pounding that if we didn't have the right mics, you wouldn't hear the taps at all, especially on the close floor stuff. So that I'm going to do a sound check when I leave here.
You must have danced on a lot of floors during
your
career.
Oh, yes. The kids are very amazed at that, especially when they see Greg and I dance together, because we can literally dance on anything. I mean, the kids today say, well, it's too slippery. So, and then they will watch me when we're doing our nightclub. Because nightclub floors, they put the wax on it for the people to dance on. They don't care about the performers. Most nightclubs don't really care. And through the years, Greg and I have had to dance on, I think the slipperiest floor was the basketball floor. We used to do halftime shows for the Globetrotters, Harlem Globetrotters, us and Cab Calloway. And that floor was like ice. And yet we were doing splits, jumps, leaps, close floor work. Because you just did it.
You ever hurt yourself on a slippery floor?
No. No. No, we never did, Greg and I.
I would think it's like going to a club when you're a pianist and finding that no one's tuned the piano.
Yes,
middle C doesn't work.
but then you depend, that's experience. Then you depend on each other for support. You get so you know. So I can stand, walk on the floor and tell immediately. And I can literally do, like, we rehearsed last night in the rehearsal studios above the stage at the Academy of Music, and the floor was unbelievably slippery. The dancers were slippery and falling, but I have to do a three-movement piece to Errol Garner. It's a three-variation. It's a tribute to him. And in the middle section, I do lots of balletic kind of things, control stuff and spins and stuff, and they were amazed that I could do that. But it's just, I have to do it. There's no choice. You have no choice. You know? So once you know that, then the professionalism comes out, which is what I'm about.
How do you want to divide your time between live performance, between your company and movies?
Well, my company is the priority right now. I got a call from Fred Roos, who is the head casting gentleman for Spielberg, Lucas, Coppola, Scorsese. He is the man. And he called me up and he told me he was very complimentary, and I was very happy about that since I hadn't seen my work in the movie. And he wanted to know if I wanted a movie career. So I said I never thought of it. I was very grateful to get the part in a major movie. I'm very happy about it. But my Ballet Tap USA is my priority right now. But I certainly would love to do another movie if it was the right part. Because he said I could have a career very similar to Pacino or Dustin Hoffman. I was amazed at that because I don't see myself as an actor, you see. But they do. And my brother told me they see something in you that you will never see, you see. So Greg and I want to do movies together. We had an idea about doing the Bob Hope, Bing Crosby Road movies, update that. which we may do in the future. We're going to do a television special. But the company that I have has been booked through most of 84 and 85, and we haven't premiered it yet. So it's so encouraging. You know, I think people are very interested more than anything else. So I'm excited about it. So I have to spend time with that. I want to.
Well, good luck with it.
Oh, thank you. I'm enjoying it. I'm the happiest. I mean, if you come see it, if you're able to come see it, you will see a truly happy person. I am so happy. I mean, I can't wait to get out there, you know, because it's new. I've never done concert dance, you see, and it's easy for me.
How do you like being a manager now?
Because I don't like
you're
it.
Running the company as well as
yes,
performing in it.
I don't like that part of it. It's and have to perform too, because I found last night working, I was forgetting a few steps, and my retaining power has always been good, but it's because my mind is thinking, okay, is the floor going to be right? Are my dancers happy? Is Mercedes okay? You know, I can't, you know, so it's very difficult for me. It's new. But when I start to dance and we all dance together, we do a 35-minute tribute to Duke Ellington, in that we do his version of Pretty, it's called Pretty and the Wolf, which is his version of Little Red Riding Hood, where I play the wolf very Cab Calloway-ish in a white zoot suit, and Mercedes plays this little country girl, and I try to seduce her and stuff. And it's a wonderful ballet, and when I get into that, I'm out there. I'm transported. I mean, I love dancing. The dancers are amazed at me because I'm able to dance. My stamina is high. Because, I mean, Sophisticated Ladies, I did 16 numbers a show, 8 performances a week. In nightclubs, you do 2 shows a night for months, no day off. So this, yeah, I'm dancing 3 times. Granted, the Errol Garner tribute is rough because it's 3 variations, and Pretty in the Wolf is 35 minutes, but that's easy for me, you know?
I think one of the things that a manager of a company has to do is learn how to balance everybody's egos,
because yes,
there's a lot of ego in performance,
yes,
and show business. Has,
yes,
that been difficult to do?
Yes. Yes and no. Because I realized that I am the director of the company. Before, I was fighting against that. I wanted to remain one of the dancers, one of the kids, one of the group. No, they're looking for someone to say, hey, this is what it is. We can discuss it, but I have to make the decision. Whatever, right or wrong, I'm certainly going to make mistakes and have. I made a lot of mistakes starting the company, but I've learned from them very quickly. I'm a very quick study. So now I know I have to take charge, and I'm not one of them. I'm the director of the company, and they want me to be the director of the company. See, I didn't know that.
You weren't initially willing to be the boss.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't. And they guided me into that position.
How did they do that?
By telling me, someone has got to take charge. You've got to. We've got to know. If we can't come to you and you say, this is what it is, even if we discuss it, who can we go to? You know, Mercedes is the co-director. We will go to her. But you founded the company, and you must be the one to make the final decision. And I respect them for that. They made me grow up.
Did you initially want to do a more cooperative relationship?
Yes, I did. I wanted to, let's have fun and games and be happy, but it can't be that. It has to be, you know, especially with 12 dancers and 12 different personalities. And they are quite different. And they're brilliant dancers. They are brilliant. I watched them the other night when we did a run-through the other afternoon, and I was amazed. I was amazed. I think they're all absolutely fabulous.
Well, I wish you the best with the company. I want to thank you so much for talking with
me. I've enjoyed it, too. You're very, very nice.
Thanks. I really had a ball. Thanks a lot.
All right.